statewide prescription monitoring programs, or PMPs, so doctors could check a patient's prescription records and prevent themselves from being shopped. Members would sponsor drug prevention workshops in schools and hold signs outside Purdue's corporate headquarters featuring poster-sized pictures of their dead kids. They would battle online and at times in person with chronic pain patients who praised the drug for allowing them to function and to sleep through the night. Bish suspected, correctly in a few cases, that some were paid advocates hired by Purdue to troll his website and post contrary views. From court cases to medical seminars, Rapp could be counted on to turn up whenever and wherever Purdue was in the news. In 2003, its members traveled from Rhode Island and New Jersey to rally outside a drug abuse prevention conference held in Orlando at the Carib Royale Resort because Purdue was an exhibitor at the conference. The protesters were already battling the rain when Bish began reading aloud the names of 260 people memorialized on his website, only to have an unidentified woman turn a sprinkler on them. A hotel executive denied having anything to do with soaking the parents. A Purdue Pharma spokesman at the event told an Orlando Sentinel reporter, "We offer our sincere condolences to anyone who has suffered the loss of a loved one from a drug overdose," but insisted that Purdue's marketing of OxyContin had been appropriate. Raised Catholic and deeply religious, Lee Nuss began wearing a pair of rosary beads for protection at such events. As an added talisman, she carried a tiny bronze urn in which she tucked a portion of her son's remains. As she explained it to me, "I leave the main urn at home on my mantle, but when I leave the house, I like to have Randy right there with me." The memorials kept flooding the message board. When Barbara Van Rooyen's 24-year-old son Patrick died in 2004 after ingesting his first and only OxyContin at a 4th of July party, she reached out to Bish, who put her in touch with Van Zee. "At the time, I knew very little about the drug other than Rush Limbaugh had been addicted to it," she told me. Van Rooyen, who lived in Folsom, California, had also read about Van Zee's battle with Purdue in Painkiller, and she had one central question for the country doctor. How the hell had such a strong drug come on the market to begin with? Van Zee walked her through the FDA's 1995 approval of the drug, led by its top examiner, Curtis Wright. Van Zee just happened to have a copy of the company's new drug application, or NDA, a document trove that had been a Christmas gift from Suella in 2000. "It was all I wanted that year," Van Zee told me. Suella admired the way her mild-mannered husband was stifling his hard-wired passivity to stand up for the region, yet she increasingly resented the time it took away from their family life. "We used to try to go a day without saying the words addiction or OxyContin, but we've never made it, not once," she said. Though Purdue claimed it had no idea of the drug's abuse problems until February 2000, Wright had signed off on a 1995 filed NDA review that spelled out how crushing the tablets would lead to immediate, rather than controlled, release of the drug, that withdrawal symptoms had been witnessed in several patients during clinical trials, and that 68% of the oxycodone was in fact recoverable from one single crushed-up pill when liquefied and injected. In a summary of his approval, Wright had even urged caution in the product's marketing materials. Care should be taken to limit competitive promotion. In fact, minimal care had been taken in the drug's promotion. Wright would go on to work as a consultant for Purdue Pharma 2 years later. Van Zee told Van Rooyen, too, about the eight-hour drive to Maryland he'd made in January 2002 to testify before an FDA advisory committee convened to discuss the agency's role in approving and overseeing the management of narcotics. That meeting pitted Van Zee, wearing his only suit and a Jerry Garcia necktie his mother had given him, against Purdue executives and some of the nation's top pain management experts, most of them acknowledging that they were or had been paid speakers for Purdue. Van Zee found himself outnumbered 19-1, a harrowing experience for a loner not accustomed to public speaking. "I get nervous," he told me. "It was intimidating, especially in front of my peers, all of whom had big reputations in the field, but this was my responsibility to do, and I did feel like I was speaking truth to power." "He practiced and practiced and practiced," added Suella, who accompanied him on the trip. "I tend to be emotional when I speak, but Art is so careful about saying only what he absolutely knows to be true. His ego is never invested." The gist of Banzi's opposition, as outlined by one Purdue-funded speaker, we are allowing the abuse and the ignorance of the few to affect the potential health for the many. Remember, the biggest form of drug abuse today is undertreatment, and this is a crime that we can all eradicate. The next morning, in a 10-minute conversation with the country's elder statesman of pain management, Dr. Russell Portnoy, Banzi asked Portnoy to describe what he believed to be an acceptable level of addiction risk from OxyContin. Given that the less than 1% figure trotted out repeatedly from the 1980 medical journal letter was out of date and applied only to a hospital setting, rather than in the context of chronic pain treated at home, Banzi asked Portnoy, hadn't that been a meaningless calculator of long-term risk? He showed Portnoy an OxyContin distribution map, highlighting the overlap between heightened crime and drug abuse in regions like Lee County, where OxyContin was prescribed at a rate 300 to 600% above the national average. That's good, Portnoy responded. The more opioids that were out there, the better to meet the needs of chronic pain patients. But what if the risk of addiction is 5 or 6%? Banzi persisted. What do you consider acceptable collateral damage if you create 50,000 patients that are opioid addicts? The country doctor's single-mindedness exasperated Portnoy, who walked away. Although a decade later, Portnoy conceded to Wall Street Journal reporters that he and other pain doctors had mistakenly overstated the benefits of opioids while discounting their risks. Back then, Banzi was the doctor whose judgment was questioned and even mocked. A lot of people discounted Art as a rebel rouser and a kook, a prominent Virginia healthcare administrator explained. Another parent activist suggested that Banzi's uncomfortable and slightly disheveled appearance helped Purdue cast him as a kook rather than the groundbreaking physician he was. He should have gotten the Nobel Peace Prize, she said. Banzi pressed on, raising similar concerns at the end of the 2002 hearing with the FDA committee's chairman, Dr. Nathaniel Katz. He told Katz he'd spent months looking for studies that addressed the long-term abuse risk to patients who use painkillers. There's a reason you didn't find any, Katz, also a prominent pain doctor, explained. They don't exist. This time it was Banzi's turn to walk away. It dawned on him then that the only detailed study about potential abuse was the one that Purdue itself had undertaken in 1995 for its NDA, the one he'd read about in the gift from his wife, the one that noted that 68% of the drug could be extracted from a crushed tablet. The FDA form ended with experts urging the agency to closely monitor abuse and addiction as soon as new drugs went to market. But for Van Royen's son Patrick, the efforts were way too little, way too late. A year before his death, the FDA had missed another opportunity to help her son when it chose not to restrict the use of OxyContin to severe pain, a move that might have reduced addiction without compromising terminally ill or dying patients' access to the drug. Van Royen was never against the use of OxyContin for terminal pain, but argued that it should not be used for chronic non-cancer pain unless all other treatments have first been explored. To this day, I believe OxyContin has a place for terminal end-of-life care and for acute pain when other lesser opioids haven't worked, she told me. But it was clear as early as 2004 to Van Royen, then a researcher, professor, and college counselor, that the FDA failed to protect the public, her son included, not only when it approved the drug, but also multiple times thereafter. It would not come to light for 9 more years that FDA regulators and big pharma executives have been quietly holding private meetings at expensive hotels at least annually since 2002 through a drug industry-funded nonprofit, an ethical quandary a Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reporter shone the light on in 2013. The meetings led to the development of enriched enrollment, an aptly named practice that allowed drug companies to weed out people from their studies who didn't respond well to their drugs, therefore tipping the balance toward FDA approval of new drugs and away from science. Pay-for-play is just not the way the FDA operates, an FDA regulatory official claimed when the investigation broke. That's not part of the culture of the FDA. The same Journal Sentinel reporter, John Fauber, would also uncover how the American Pain Society and the American Academy of Pain Medicine pushed for expanded use of opioids for long-term chronic pain while taking in millions from the companies that made them. His articles prompted a 2012 Senate investigation led by Senators Chuck Grassley and Max Baucus that targeted both the American Pain Foundation and Purdue, among other nonprofits and pharmaceutical companies. But the results of that investigation would end up sealed in the Senate's Finance Committee's office, where they remain buried, despite periodic calls for their disclosure. A lot of us were very happy when they started the investigation, but nothing's come of it. It was never followed up on, said Dr. Steve Gelfand, a South Carolina addiction specialist and activist who helped Van Rooyen file a recall petition with the FDA. To me, it's all been just another political power play, he said. Staffers at the FDA got used to hearing the name Barbara Van Rooyen. "We all know who you are," an ombudsman told her. She was burning up their phone lines, demanding a temporary recall of OxyContin until it could be reformulated in abuse-resistant form and relabeled for severe pain only. "The FDA's recall form is long and involved, designed to make you not want to do it," Van Rooyen remembered. A similar FDA petition to force Purdue to put stronger warning labels on OxyContin, detailing the risks of frequent prescribing, had been filed by the Connecticut Attorney General in 2004 and was stalled in bureaucratic purgatory. That initial application would be rejected 4 years later in 2008. "But I'm a stubborn Dutchwoman with my degree from Berkeley, and I was used to doing research," she said. And the words of the friend who'd given Patrick the OxyContin pill haunted her as she typed. "It's kind of like a muscle relaxer, and it's FDA approved, so it's safe," he had told him. If Vanzi's decade-long quest had begun to feel quixotic, now in his 60s, he wondered how much longer he could keep up the pace of 13-hour workdays, much of them spent treating addicted patients. Van Rooyen's focus was a balm. Whereas Vanzi's earlier recall petition with its 10,000 signatures was never formally submitted to the FDA, "We simply didn't have the time, energy, staff to do that," he said. Van Rooyen was unfazed by the paperwork, happily folding Vanzi's data into hers with her physician husband's help and filing it on February 1, 2005. She testified alongside Vanzi at FDA hearings and organized a protest in her Northern California hometown outside a Purdue-funded continuing medical education seminar taught by a well-known pain clinic doctor. She waited for an answer on her FDA recall petition. And she waited. Following in her artist son's footsteps, she painted portraits of herself holding Patrick shortly after his birth, then another of his brother Andrew as she saw him in his grief at his brother's death, raw and naked, curled up in a fetal ball. "I had a feeling that things would get a lot worse before they got better," she told me. "I knew that I might not see change in my lifetime, but I was going ahead with this battle anyway." If the federal regulators weren't moved by memorials to dead Americans from their grieving mothers and fathers, maybe the country doctor and the nun and the growing team of mourning parents would finally get justice from the courts. At minimum, they hope to amplify Purdue Pharma's negative press and raise awareness about the heroin-like drug. Among the relatives against Purdue Pharma's first courtroom targets was the 2003 civil lawsuit against Purdue brought by former Florida Purdue sales rep Karen White. She'd been fired in 2002 for allegedly having paperwork irregularities, poor communication skills, and declining sales, the company said. But White claimed in her legal filing that she was actually fired for refusing to sell to doctors who were illegally overprescribing OxyContin to their patients. In the winter of 2003, the company bragged in a press release about all the civil suits it had won against people blaming their addictions on OxyContin under a headline that read like a football blowout, 65-0. "These dismissals strengthen our resolve to defend these cases vigorously and to the hilt," said General Counsel Howard Udell. "We have not settled one of these cases, not one. Personal injury lawyers who bring them in the hopes of a quick payday will continue to be disappointed." But the firm's legal bills were mounting to the tune of $3 million a month, and Purdue still had 285 lawsuits pending against it, including another whistleblower suit filed by Marek Zakruski, an assistant research director who described raising safety concerns with 17 different higher-ups about the serious negative implications of the drugs, according to his complaint. His bosses banned him from undertaking additional research into the problems and even from informing the company's regulatory department about his concerns, his suit claimed. Fired in May 2003 after complaining to the FDA, Zakrzewski eventually dropped his lawsuit, citing illness, the following year. He'd had a heart attack from the stress of working at Purdue Pharma and was fired while on medical leave, according to his filing. A Purdue spokesman countered that the researcher dropped the suit after the firm refused to settle the case, calling the allegations baseless. To help burnish its image in the face of so many legal, financial, and public relations problems, Purdue hired former New York mayor and Republican insider Rudy Giuliani and his consulting firm, Giuliani Partners. Just a few months after his lauded response to the 9/11 terrorist attacks, Giuliani's job was to convince public officials they could trust Purdue because they could trust him, as Barry Meyer and another writer at the New York Times put it. The DEA was already investigating lax security standards at the company's manufacturing plants following the 2001 arrest of two Purdue employees accused of trying to steal thousands of pills. Giuliani brokered a behind-the-scenes negotiation of the fine paid by the Purdue affiliate that ran its New Jersey pill factory, including the condition that the firm pay a $2 million civil penalty without admitting any wrongdoing. The DEA's diversion control manager, tasked with making sure drugs are lawfully used and not diverted into illicit trafficking, was left fuming. She had argued for a $10 million fine. She was sure Giuliani and company executives had gone over her head to her boss in an attempt to gain access and insights into how to manage things politically. At a luncheon, Giuliani had helped raise $20,000 for a new DEA museum historical exhibit. Facing a growing number of lawsuits and investigations, Purdue Pharma heaped praise on its American hero and new political star. "We believe that government officials are more comfortable knowing that Giuliani is advising Purdue Pharma," Udell gushed in a promotional brochure. "It is clear to us, and we hope it is clear to the government, that Giuliani would not take an assignment with a company that he felt was acting in an improper way." After all, not only was Giuliani old pals with the DEA director, but he also had just been named Time Magazine's Person of the Year 2001. The terrorist attacks had elevated Giuliani's stature, but in a boon moment for his future employer, they also temporarily diverted media attention from OxyContin. A sales executive said as much to Purdue employees on September 12th via voicemail, giving them the day off. The message the sales manager left, according to a former Purdue staffer, "At least the tragedy for the nation would take OxyContin off the front pages of the nation's newspapers." The rap parents believed White's wrongful termination case would prove that Purdue's marketing practices had crossed a legal line. "We had such high hopes that she would be one of our saviors," Van Royen said. Ed Bish drove 12 hours from Philadelphia in 2005 so he could sit in a Tampa federal courtroom beside Lee Nuss at Karen White's civil trial, the first case against Purdue to progress beyond summary judgment. White was asking the jury to award her $138,000 in lost wages plus $690,000 for emotional pain. Depressed and anxious since her dismissal, she had never before been fired from a job. "They were counting on us to run out of steam," Bish recalled. "They were all lawyered up and Rudy Giuliani'd up." He counted 10 lawyers on Purdue's side, not including staff, quarterbacked by the formidable Atlanta-based firm of King & Spalding, whose clients range from cigarette makers to Coca-Cola. White's lone attorney estimated Purdue spent $500,000 defending the case, an amount a Purdue spokesman declined to confirm. White was tall and trim, a 36-year-old brunette based in Lakeland, Florida. She'd been a champion of the drug's painkilling properties early on, having witnessed her mother's painful premature death from cancer. White argued that she was wrongly fired for refusing to participate in aggressive marketing of OxyContin that, in her opinion, several times crossed the line into breaking the law. White's attorney named two specific doctors she was urged to call on who were widely known for overprescribing. Both eventually lost their medical licenses for shoddy prescribing, including one who'd handed out prescription drugs in exchange for sex. At the time, prescription drug abuse had become so rampant in White's Florida sales territory that one opioid-addicted Orange County veterinarian had recently been caught using the names of several pet owners' dogs. They were named Brutus, Cha-Cha, and Lady, to forge more than 1,000 OxyContin prescriptions. White had a single lawyer and no staff, not unless you counted Bish, Lee Nuss, and Nuss's late son, Randy, who was tucked inside her mini urn. Nuss also brought her rosary beads, loaning an extra set to White to hold during the proceedings. A few days into the trial, Nuss realized she'd accidentally left the beads behind in her car. Excusing herself to retrieve them, she handed White her son's urn to hold during her absence at the plaintiff's table. "Really?" White said, tearing up, as Nuss recalled it. "You would let me do that?" When Nuss returned with the beads, she was surprised to see White coming out of the courtroom so soon. A recess had already been called. "Where's Ed?" she asked. "He had to leave the building," White told her, adding, "Lee, please, don't get upset." "Why?" Nuss wanted to know. "You're not going to believe this, but Ed had to take your son out of the courthouse." Purdue's lawyers had heard about the urn and asked the judge to have it removed from the building. Bish and White expected the grieving mom to blow up, but Nuss surprised them by laughing instead. She told her friends, "My son is not here in body, but he is definitely here in spirit. He might have left the building, but he will be back." Bish was due back at work in Philly before the jury's decision came in, but he was not surprised when Nuss called with the verdict. "Ed, there's just too much money involved," she told him. "We really thought we were doing something, only to find out nobody is going to do anything." The jury ruled in favor of Purdue, whose lawyer called the case a personal disagreement with promoting the drug in an entirely legal way. While White believed calling on sleazy pill prescribers was illegal, her lawyer had not proved the illegality of the company's sales strategies. The court basically said, "Don't tell us what you believe, tell us what you know," explained University of Kentucky legal scholar Richard Osness, who has written about the difficulty of winning civil cases against Purdue, citing, among other reasons, the company's hefty defense chest. At the request of a Purdue lawyer, the government's highly critical 2003 Government Accountability Office study of Purdue's marketing practices was ruled inadmissible in court. During the first decade of the drug's existence, the legal system could not prove the makers of OxyContin had broken the law. Back in Western Virginia, a young U.S. attorney with political aspirations was secretly working on his own attempt to defeat Purdue in court as early as 2003. John L. Brownlee was brash, a little bit of a cowboy, and as a former paratrooper and Army Reserve JAG Corps captain, the 36-year-old was not afraid of high-stakes drama or the press. He was married to a local news anchor, Leanne Necessary, whom he'd met on the job a decade earlier. With a ruddy complexion and a mop of reddish-brown hair, he had a boyish appearance that belied his hard-charging demeanor. If Law and Order sold action figures, they would look like John Brownlee, down to the crisp creases in his trousers and his American flag lapel pin. Brownlee became so fond of calling press conferences that he traveled with a portable podium with fold-out legs. His prosecuting philosophy, "If you're not losing sometimes, you're not going after the hard cases." By the time Karen White's case was dismissed in 2003, Brownlee was still smarting over his own trial loss via an acquittal, hung jury, and dismissal in a multiple wrongful death suit against Roanoke pain specialist Dr. Cecil Knox, whose office had been raided by federal agents stormtrooper style. Knox and several of his office workers had been handcuffed and carted away. One of the women was carrying her groceries out of a store, even though defense attorneys had already arranged with federal authorities for their clients to turn themselves in. The showboating earned Brownlee a reputation as aggressive and at times overreaching. On the heels of the Knox case and another high-profile case that generated equally fierce public criticism and ended similarly with two hung juries, Brownlee needed a big legal win. With plans to seek elected office, Brownlee would run for Virginia Attorney General in 2008, he may have viewed prosecuting Purdue Pharma as a vehicle for being in the national news, recalled Lawrence Hammock, a longtime Roanoke Times reporter and my former colleague, who chronicled OxyContin's spread. "Yes, he had self-serving motivations," Hammock said, "but on the other hand, OxyContin abuse was happening everywhere in the country and no one else took them on." Brownlee did, almost immediately after being appointed U.S. attorney, though he didn't go public with the investigation until 2005. He had read Meyer's Painkiller and knew about Purdue's attempt to bully the journalist after its publication. Purdue lawyer Howard Udell complained to Meyer's New York Times editors claiming that Meyer had a conflict of interest in the story. His book, Purdue argued, gave him a financial stake in the newspaper's continued coverage of OxyContin. Udell wanted Meyer taken off the beat. Their agenda was to shut me down and to suppress as much news coverage of the company as possible, Meyer recalled. And he, the newspaper's public editor, Daniel Okrent, bid on it, not realizing that what they weren't telling him was that they were already under criminal investigation, which Meyer suspected. With two minor exceptions, Meyer would not write about Purdue Pharma for the newspaper again for 4 years. Meyer may have been temporarily silenced from writing about the company, but nothing prevented John Brownlee from poring over the footnotes of his book. Brownlee also relied on an eager fraud investigator in his office, Greg Wood, to communicate with Van Zee and the Rapp parents. Since the epidemic's early days, long before Google alerts, Wood had been sending out regular compilations of OxyContin-related news articles and overdose statistics via email to law enforcement agents, prosecutors, and other interested parties. Recipients who spotted any OxyContin news in their locality should let me know, Wood urged at the top of every update, which Van Zee nicknamed the Wood Reports. Never assume, I already know, Wood enthused. Greg Wood was very high energy, Van Zee recalled. He would get up in the middle of the night checking for stories. As health fraud investigator for the U.S. Attorney's Office in Roanoke, Wood was tasked with picking through the weeds of the civil cases against Purdue, most filed by small-town lawyers who were trying in vain to challenge the company for overpromoting the drug while ignoring its risks for addiction. Their clients range from miners and masonry workers who became addicted following work-related injuries to a factory worker so desperate to stop taking OxyContin that he'd flushed his pills down the toilet, telling his lawyer that trying to explain dope sickness to a non-addict was like describing an elephant to a blind man. The lawyers, the parents, Van Zee, and Sister Beth all were happy to pass along every piece of dirt they'd collected on Purdue, from sales rep call notes and depositions to Van Zee's Christmas gift from Sue Ella, the NDA. The Purdue lawyers were totally underestimating the work done by Wood, recalled Abingdon lawyer Emmett Eury, who lost his own civil case against the company. Arnold Fain McCauley, 71 when his suit was filed in 2004, had spent decades stooped over and crawling through 36-inch high Lee County coal seams. In coal mining parlance, he worked low coal, the most strenuous of the coal extracting jobs. Now that's working hard, working in low coal, Van Zee said, pointing to a picture in one of his exam rooms of a miner crawling on his knees in the dark under a sagging mass of mountain. Compared to that, all I do is move around a mouse. When he wasn't working low coal, Fain McCauley spent nights and weekends hauling and spreading lime from his truck for area farmers. Asked to describe the defining characteristic of her father, Lisa Nina McCauley Green said simply, "All I remember about him growing up is he worked." As the Virginia writer John C. Tucker described it in May God Have Mercy, for a miner who avoids being crippled, burned, or buried alive, the usual question is which will give out first. His lungs, his back, or his knees. In McCauley's case, it happened to be his shoulder, from a late 1990s injury caused by the snapping of an underground cable that slammed into his shoulder and back. Building his product liability case against Purdue, Yeary collected some 20 boxes of documents, arguing that Purdue overpromoted the prescription painkiller while ignoring its risks, rendering people like McCauley addicts while reaping billions in sales. Yeary had gotten the idea for the lawsuit in 2000 after hearing Van Zee give a community college lecture on OxyContin. Yeary hadn't been particularly interested in the topic, but went along to satisfy a schoolteacher he was dating at the time. As Van Zee went through his slides, ranging from overdose deaths to spikes in Oxy-related crime committed by addicted users, all of it meticulously sourced and footnoted, Yeary leaned over to a lawyer friend sitting on his other side and said, "Damn. They're putting the wrong people in jail." He remembered thinking Van Zee was not the kind of guy you raised hell with in college. It occurred to him then that the country doctor was the perfect conduit for helping him identify plaintiffs to sue Purdue. In fact, it was Van Zee who eventually connected Yeary to McCauley, a patient Van Zee was by then treating for OxyContin addiction. But like most of the civil plaintiffs suing Purdue, Fain McCauley was an imperfect client, because he admitted under oath that he had taken multiple drugs, gradually supplementing his original OxyContin prescriptions with OxyContin he'd bought on the streets. When his original doctor, Richard C. Norton, tried to wean him from the drug, cutting him back from 40 to 20 milligrams, it had made McCauley extremely nervous, crippling him with diarrhea, sweats, and a skin-crawling feeling he called goose flesh. McCauley bought the black market OxyContin, he told an opposing lawyer from Purdue in a series of depositions, for the same reason a century's worth of heroin addicts have kept returning to their dealers for more dope, to stave off dope sickness. It didn't matter that the septuagenarian hadn't been stealing from his granddaughter before OxyContin came along, or cashing out his relative's life insurance policies, or borrowing guns for protection from his new pill-peddling associates. It didn't matter that he'd been treated with lower-strength opioids after losing two fingers to a 1980 coal mining accident, but did not develop a $300-a-day drug habit until 1999, shortly after his first bottle of OxyContin. Nor did it matter that people like Van Zee had urged Dr. Norton not to fall for the Purdue rep's spiel about the great epidemic of untreated severe pain. Van Zee had seen Norton's clinic in nearby Duffield with its parking lot full of out-of-state cars and confronted him about it at a hospital meeting. "I said, you know, Rich, people are injecting this," and he was astounded, Van Zee recalled. In 2000, Norton was sentenced to 5 years in federal prison, not for overprescribing OxyContin, but for his role in an unrelated hospital corruption scheme. According to sales rep notes subpoenaed in the McCauley case, federal prosecutors were also investigating Norton for operating a pill mill, but opted to front burner the wider and more urgent corruption case. Stollard, the Big Stone Gap drug detective, remembered an informant unpacking the life of a Norton patient. He told us, "Dr. Norton wrote prescriptions for Lortab, 40 milligram OxyContins, and 80 milligram Oxys all in the same visit." When Stollard subpoenaed the physician's records, he saw Norton had prescribed thousands of OxyContin pills in just 30 days. Stollard turned the information over to Brownlee's assistant prosecutors, who said physician cases were difficult to prove since there was always another paid physician expert willing to testify that such prescription dosages were necessary. Nonetheless, the prosecutors brought in DEA agents to help target the most egregious prescribers, and local detectives started feeding them information, Stollard said. "We sent all kinds of information into the feds, but we never got anything back out of them. They told us nothing," he added, of Brownlee and his assistant prosecutors. "We started calling them the Shadow Company." The federal investigation actually began when the shadow company realized Norton was simply following his Purdue rep's guidelines to a T, Stollard said. But none of that counted in the civil cases against Purdue, wherein plaintiffs had to prove that a specific injury was directly tied to company wrongdoing with such specificity that a reasonable jury could assign the wrongdoing a dollar amount. Federal Judge James P. Jones dismissed the McCauley case on the grounds that a jury would not have been able to divine whether OxyContin alone had caused the coal miner's suffering. Though other judges across the country simply dismissed the OxyContin lawsuits, Jones took the unusual step of inserting a personal opinion into his ruling. "Does the relief afforded by high-dosage opioids to those with severe, life-altering pain outweigh the risks of harm from addiction?" he wrote. McCauley's case did not answer that question, he said. A God-fearing Baptist, Fain McCauley had loved country music and the Atlanta Braves. Everyone in the town of Jonesville knew him because he had refereed home basketball games at Lee High School for many years. His family had sent him to rehab 7 times before and after the case. Every time, he'd come back and lie to us and say he's not taking the pills anymore when we knew he was, his daughter Lisa Green told me. McCauley ended up selling family heirlooms at a flea market. He stole credit cards to buy a four-wheeler that he sold for money to buy drugs. "He would say my mom was trying to kill him when my mom doesn't have a mean bone in her body," Green added. That drug took over his brain. 2 years before her father's death, Green would drive to her parents' home to rescue her mom, bringing her back to Texas to live with her. Together they waited, cringing every time the phone rang late at night. Around dawn on October 22, 2009, it finally did. When McCauley, 75, died 4 years after his case was tried, police found him in his lime-hauling truck at 4 a.m. in the middle of a pasture. He'd crashed through a fence. Several near-empty bottles of pills, prescribed just 2 days earlier, were strewn on the seat next to him. A state trooper told McCauley's daughter and wife that he died of a heart attack, but his daughter believes he was murdered over a bad drug deal. His head was blown apart, she said, as if from a gun. The boxes of juicy sales rep call notes and depositions that represented Fane McCauley's case files did not molder in Urey's law office attic. They were folded into Wood and Brownlee's trove of ammo for their case against Purdue. By the time Urey lost the case, Brownlee's office was in the process of secretly logging millions of records on spreadsheets. The Wood reports were coming out at a rate of 4 or 5 a week, and one employee was assigned to do nothing but catalog documents for the investigation, all of them buttressing Brownlee's belief that Purdue had knowingly concealed the drug's addictiveness. When a New York Post reporter broke the news in 2005 that a federal grand jury was investigating Purdue, Van Royen told Bish and the other rat parents, "They think they're going to run roughshod over a bunch of hillbilly lawyers." She recalled how Udell had gloated over the scores of legal wins against people like McCauley and his pledge that the company would never settle such absurd lawsuits. But the company and its executives underestimated the U.S. attorney from Roanoke, who brought in prosecutors from neighboring jurisdictions and deputized them as special assistants to pick up the non-Purdue case slack. To lead the Purdue investigation, he appointed assistant U.S. attorneys Randy Ramsire and Rick Mountcastle, career government lawyers who were not given to drama and worked 3 hours west of Brownlee in the district satellite office in Abington, closer to the coalfields. It would never occur to either of them to tote around a podium or to voluntarily talk to the press. When I interviewed Ramsire almost a decade later, he deflected questions with a combination of press paranoia and aw shucks humility. "Sometimes people get intimidated by big companies and high-dollar lawyers," he said. "You just have to avoid that. And it's not rocket science. It's just hard work." But Ramsire and Mountcastle had watched their caseloads shift dramatically since OxyContin's introduction, and they were well aware that the few federal prosecutors who'd earlier tried to bring Purdue to account for rising Oxy-related crime had fallen short, with only a handful of exceptions. Jay McCloskey, the U.S. attorney in Maine, had challenged the company's promotional techniques early on with some success. He had pushed the company to drop the Dr. Junkets and the 160-milligram version of its pill, only to leave his post in 2001 to work as a consultant for, wait for it, Purdue Pharma. But the Abingdon prosecutors were content doing government work. Ramsire and Mountcastle had sent a host of pill mill doctors to jail over the years, one of whom had been doling out prescriptions from the backseat of his car. Since OxyContin's introduction, the tiny Abingdon office had successfully prosecuted 10 doctors, pharmacists, and dentists for overprescribing the drugs, including to 9-year-old kids. By the time their investigation was over, 9 state and federal agencies would spend 5 years helping the stone-faced prosecutors build the case. Unlike the civil lawsuits that preceded them, Brownlee's team had to prove only that the company had misbranded the drug, a broad and somewhat technical charge that makes it a crime to mislabel a drug or fraudulently promote it, or market it for an unapproved use. The federal prosecutors didn't have to prove the misbranding was actually responsible for the overdoses and the addiction and misuse, just that Purdue Pharma had criminally misbranded the drug, according to Hammack, the Roanoke Times Courts reporter. So it was a very murky legal line, but Randy and Rick figured it out, Hammack said. But there was definitely this feeling by Purdue that this was a little bit of a backwoods, small-town outfit. "I think they underestimated them to some degree," Hammack said. The 4-year run-up to what would eventually result in the company's plea agreement involved Purdue Pharma struggling to understand that the backwoods lawyers had, in fact, sussed out a crime inside their mound of documents. The company put a full court press on Brownlee, first with multiple phone calls from Rudy Giuliani, who attempted to unnerve the much younger man during settlement negotiations on Purdue's behalf. Brownlee had read Giuliani's book, Leadership, to get ready for his first meeting with him. "I wanted to be prepared," he said. "Look, my view of the case was, it didn't matter where we were or how small we were. To me, it demonstrated that a couple of good, smart prosecutors working out of a strip mall in Abingdon, Virginia, if they work hard and they're tenacious, they can win one of the biggest cases in Virginia," he told me. An assistant prosecutor in the case recalled that Giuliani put on a folksy front, but was not intimately involved in the negotiations details, possibly because he was pursuing what would prove to be a failed bid for the Republican presidential nomination. His role was that his star power alone was supposed to intimidate us, said an assistant federal prosecutor involved in the negotiations who was not authorized to speak publicly about the case. People say the government and all its resources, but when you're in the middle of a case like this, you don't feel that sense because they always have way more people working on the case than you have. In the fall of 2006, Purdue's lawyers began to sense that this case against them was different, that a full court press meant nothing when the opposing counsel was the United States of America. Was it really possible the small-town lawyers had compiled enough evidence to indict both the company and its top executives on a host of felony charges, not just for misbranding the drug, but also for mail fraud, wire fraud, and money laundering? It seems so, according to a memo written by the federal prosecutors to Brownlee at the time. But it got watered down as it went through the Department of Justice headquarters, and the folks working for Purdue, including Giuliani, lobbied hard for the executives not to be indicted on felony charges, said an observer connected to the case. The fines would get batted around too, with Purdue initially offering to pay $10 million compared with the government's initial proposal of $1 billion. The winnowing down of a settlement is a common part of plea agreements. Prosecutors typically threaten more serious charges, while defense lawyers counter that they'll go to trial to prove their client's innocence. Meanwhile, Giuliani's lobbying efforts arrive with the timing and authority of a flagrant foul. In 2005, Purdue lawyers called then-Deputy Attorney General James Comey to question Brownlee's investigatory tactics, and Comey called Brownlee with concerns. The young attorney responded by personally driving to Washington to lay out his strategies. "Brownlee, you are fine," Comey told him. "Go back to Virginia and do your case." But Purdue's boldest move came later in October 2006, the night before the plea agreement was set to expire, after which the company would face charges, when a senior Justice Department officer phoned Brownlee at home at a Purdue lawyer's request, urging him to extend the deadline to give Purdue more time. Brownlee was through being pressured. The lobbying and negotiations had gone on long enough. The clock had all but run out. Rather than risk more serious charges or a jury trial in Western Virginia, where the drug's problems were by now legend, the company accepted the plea agreement later that night. But Purdue wasn't quite finished negotiating. 8 days after it accepted the deal, Brownlee was stunned to see his name on a firing list, along with four other U.S. attorneys. Though he wasn't ultimately fired, the incident provided fresh criticism of then-Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez, accused of trying to sway the work of U.S. attorneys' offices. And it only underscored the long reach of Purdue. Udell's defense lawyer, Mary Jo White, a former Manhattan U.S. attorney, had been the one to press for more time in a call to a Department of Justice official. Brownlee would break down how Purdue's attempted influence peddling worked or didn't in a later Senate hearing about the case. Brownlee weathered the heat. By the time the negotiations were complete, a Purdue-owned holding company, Purdue Frederick, would plead guilty to a single misbranding felony and the company's executives to misdemeanor charges of misbranding the drug. In a bit of legal language parsing, the executives would not stipulate that they'd had direct knowledge of the misbranding, only that the court may accept these facts in support of their guilty pleas. In other words, their only crime was that they headed up a firm wherein other people committed crimes. Compared with the charges Ramsire and Mountcastle had originally threatened, the final agreement was a mixed bag. Prosecutors initially wanted to impose the $1 billion corporate fine as well as multiple felony charges against both the company and the executives. "But we got what we could get," said a prosecutor involved in the case. Purdue, for its part, had initially proposed paying $10 million and incurring no felony charges, an insult, according to a government source involved in the negotiations. It was clear they thought we'd take a very small sum of money and go away, because it would be a lot of money for a district of our size, the source said. "I will tell you, what we ended up with was far closer to where we started than where they started." Their lawyers were shocked, the negotiator added. "They did not expect the firmness with which we approached this. Had they not agreed, we were fully prepared to take them to trial." The Sacklers, anyway, were convinced. Midway through the negotiations, following a Washington meeting of both sides, word filtered down from the Sackler family. "We can't buy our way out of this one. Make this case go away," the government negotiator recalled. If that meant throwing three executives under the bus, well then, the men had been loyal employees for many years, but the Sacklers had to do what the Sacklers had to do. The Sacklers understood that a federal jury convened in Southwest Virginia, a region that had now seen as many as 200 OxyContin-related deaths, could have awarded far harsher penalties. "We weren't just trying to get a little bit of money from them. The goal was to stop the criminal behavior, punish it, and to strip them of their profits," the negotiator said. On a clear day in May 2007, in the atrium of a downtown Roanoke office building, Brownlee unveiled the news of the settlement. The company and its top executives would plead guilty to their role in a marketing blitz that hyped OxyContin's strengths while downplaying its propensity for addiction and abuse. To resolve the federal criminal and civil misbranding charges, Purdue would pay $600 million in fines and admit that for 6 years it had fraudulently marketed OxyContin as being less prone to abuse and having fewer narcotic side effects than instant-release versions of the drug, a felony misbranding charge. Top executives Paul Goldenheim, Michael Friedman, and Udell would pony up $34.5 million, or rather the firm would, on their behalf, and plead guilty to misdemeanor versions of the crime. The fines against Purdue and its executives accounted for about 90% of the company's profits from the time the drug went on the market in 1996 until 2001, when Purdue dropped the insert language about the time-lapse mechanism's ability to reduce the abuse liability of the drug, Brownlee explained. It was the 11th largest fine paid by a pharmaceutical firm in the Justice Department's history. Best of all for people like Bish, Van Royen, and Nuss, an Abingdon sentencing hearing was planned for mid-July that would bring the Connecticut executives face-to-face with the grieving parents who were invited to discuss, on record, in court, the damage OxyContin had wrought. The executives would not serve any jail time per the plea agreement, though it was ultimately up to the judge at their court appearance to sign off on the deal and outline the exact terms of their probation and community service. Brownlee enjoyed presenting his evidence at the press conference, unfolding his podium against a staggering backdrop of documents amassed by Greg Wood, the stoic prosecutors Randy Ramsire and Rick Mountcastle, and scores of others recruited to the team, all of whom stood to his right. To his left sat an assortment of evidence culled from 2,000 cardboard containers they'd filled with documents, depositions, and data. The boxes were lined up in columns 4 to 5 feet high. For added visual effect, Brownlee displayed falsified charts created by Purdue that had claimed smooth and sustained blood levels and fewer peaks and valleys for patients on OxyContin. The ginned-up graphs were meant to buttress the drugmaker's claim that OxyContin had less potential for abuse. An adjacent easel featured actual clinical data that the prosecutors had culled from Purdue's own studies. The real data looked like a map of steep mountains, the fake data like a single gentle slope. The fluctuations measured, in hours and milligrams, the difference between truth and lies. These charts represented 2 of 46 assertions in a statement of facts drawn up by Brownlee's team and agreed to by Purdue, underscoring that the company had knowingly falsified several claims about the drug. Among them were numerous instances of Purdue quashing data critical of the drug, such as early reports of patients complaining of withdrawal symptoms. "I would not write it up at this point," one supervisor advised an employee, saying it might add to the negative press. Another fact highlighted the claim sales reps made to some doctors that oxycodone was harder to extract from OxyContin for IV use than other pain medications, when Purdue's own study showed that a drug abuser could recover 68% of the drug from a single pill. Likewise, the company conceded that some reps falsely claimed OxyContin caused less euphoria and was less likely to be diverted than Percocet and other immediate-release opioids, and could therefore be used to weed out addicts and drug seekers. It had all come from the shadow company's warehouse, as the prosecutors called it. The hillbilly lawyers had filled so many boxes with evidence that Brownlee had to rent extra space in an Abingdon strip mall to hold them all. Chapter 4. The Corporation Feels No Pain. Abingdon is a legal and artistic hub of far southwest Virginia, a quaint town full of restored colonial-era brick buildings. By the time Purdue executives turned up there to be sentenced in 2007, it was better known for upscale boutiques, arts and crafts than for its 20th-century role as a way station for coal trains hauling the prosperity out of places like St. Charles, some 80 miles west. That summer, the novelist Barbara Kingsolver was about to launch a trendy farm-to-table restaurant, The Harvest Table, in nearby Meadowview, an outgrowth of her memoir, Animal Vegetable Miracle, A Year of Food Life, then on the bestseller list. Abingdon had nurtured the early acting talents of Ernest Borgnine and Gregory Peck in its storied barter theater, named for Depression-era theatergoers' practice of trading a live chicken for the privilege of watching a play. Just a few months before the Purdue sentencing in the spring of 2007, the barter stage featured a homegrown comedy about the widow of a moonshiner who, fallen on destitute times, goes into the business of selling OxyContin, supplying her enterprise with stolen pills and those from her own prescribed stash. When Sister Beth Davies saw the play, she alternately cried at the ruined lives, marveled at the Appalachian resourcefulness, and laughed at the snappy dialogue. "If you don't laugh sometimes, you'll go crazy," she said. For a town with a population of just 8,000, Abingdon had also nurtured a surplus of lawyers over the years who were able to walk from their historic homes to both the federal and the state courthouses, passing statues of Confederate soldiers and historical Daniel Boone markers along the way. The lawyers and coal mine operators who lived here were more accustomed to fine dining and theater than rallies or protests. But in a steady rain that fell over the small mountain town, families who'd lost relatives to OxyContin converged on July 20, 2007, to speak their piece and to watch Udell, Friedman, and Goldenheim squirm in their federal courthouse seats. Barbara Van Rooyen had flown in from her home in California. She wore the same blue floral sundress and white sandals that she'd worn to her son's celebration of life and carried a sign she'd made that read, "One Pill Kills." Sister Beth Davies had driven in from Pennington Gap and marched in her raincoat with a sign of her own. It featured a picture of Ed Bish's ruddy-cheeked son, Eddie, in his prom tux. Van Zee had an out-of-state family commitment, his octogenarian father's birthday, and couldn't make it to Abingdon. But he left behind detailed notes for Sister Beth about everything from the sound system for the rally to bottled water for participants, plus talking points for follow-up letters to the editor. He and Sue Ellett were now attending funerals weekly, many of them his former patients, sometimes at a rate of two a day. He had even written a poem about one, titled OxyContin, published in Annals of Internal Medicine. "It might have been easier if OxyContin swallowed the mountains and took the promises of tens of thousands of young lives slowly, like ever-encroaching kudzu. Instead, it engulfed us, gently as napalm would a schoolyard. Mama said, as hard as it was to bury Papa after the top fell in the mine up Caney Creek, it was harder yet to find Sis that morning, cold and blue, with a needle stuck up her arm. Top of her class, with nothing but promise ahead, until hijacked by the torment of needle and spoon." Ed Bish and Lee Nuss had driven up together from her home in Florida, recycling the same signs they'd carried to the Orlando protest, only a little crumpled from the Caribe Royale sprinkler assault. It fell to Bish to lead the parade of 50 grieving relatives from a small park to the courthouse. His sign read, "Oxy Kills," in big block letters. Nuss, a tiny redhead, was dwarfed by a larger-than-life photograph of her son Randy, handsome and olive-skinned. It matched the giant magnet she'd plastered on her car at the suggestion of her grief counselor, meant to warn other families wherever she drove, in love and memory of Randall Nuss and others. More than a decade later, as journalists and policymakers tried to pinpoint where and how the opioid crisis began, Images from the rainy rally in Abingdon would get recycled in news accounts. The prescient parents marching with their signs, and next to them Sister Beth standing defiant. A look on her face that projected equal parts anger for what had happened and worry for what was coming next. The Purdue executives had flown in on a private jet from Connecticut the night before for the sentencing hearing, staying at the elegant, historic Martha Washington Inn, conveniently located next to the courthouse. To avoid the protesters, their attorneys had asked the judge for permission to enter the two-story courthouse by a back door. But Judge James Jones, a straight shooter with a booming voice, had watched his docket be overtaken by OxyContin-related crime. No, Judge Jones ordered. The executives would enter through the front door of the courthouse just like everyone else. Barry Myers stood off to the side, taking it all in. He'd been to Abingdon once before, in May, when Udell, Goldenheim, and Friedman made their first visit to deliver their guilty pleas. Meyer wanted to witness that occasion so badly that he had arrived the night before, staying in a motel on the outskirts of Abingdon, and he wanted his appearance to be a surprise. He and a freelance photographer the New York Times hired from Roanoke would hide out near the front of the hotel, ducked between parked cars, staking out the executives. Meyer had interviewed the men many times before in their corporate offices and on the phone, but he wanted to witness their Appalachian reckoning firsthand. It was his 58th birthday, and the veteran journalist could not have been happier with his gift. "Everything I'd written was now justified," he told me. As he and the photographer stood up, Udell, Goldenheim, and Friedman seemed stunned to see them, Meyer recalled. Goldenheim, the scientist, stared steely-eyed toward the camera while Udell and Friedman glanced quickly away. In a rally before the sentencing hearing, the parents took turns reading the names of the dead. Bish had printed them out from his message board memorials, now so numerous that the document was more than 50 pages long. Their voices broke periodically as they choked out the names. Bobby Lee Ashcraft, Jr., age 19. Paul Abuada, 22. Heather Marie Goslanowski, 15. Nicole Notaro, 19. They got through only 10 pages before the hearing began. In a photograph that ran in the next day's New York Times, two moms in matching rain scarves held each other, one clutching a poster of her 17-year-old daughter. In loving memory of Sarah Nicole, her life was a life worth living. Behind them stood Van Royen in her sundress, blue for her son's favorite color, holding her prepared remarks. Before the day was over, the executives would hear themselves described as corporate drug lords and marketing tricksters, on a par with Colombian cartels and P.T. Barnum. They would be asked to imagine themselves in the shoes of a parent of a college junior. What if it was your son or daughter you saw in the morgue when we went there, and he was autopsied, sliced, and diced? The executives would have their integrity questioned and their futures threatened. "I will reach out to any organization that Mr. Friedman speaks to about having a member of his family survive the Holocaust, and contact that group and say to them that Friedman is no better than Adolf Hitler, who killed and destroyed countless lives. Hitler through death and torture, Friedman through death and addiction," said Marianne Skolek, who lost her 29-year-old daughter, Jill. Skolek brought along her grandson, Brian, who was 6 years old when his mother died of an overdose of prescribed OxyContin in 2002. "Brian is here in the courtroom with me today because he needed to see that bad things do happen to bad people," Skolek said. "But not bad enough," the parents told the judge. The plea agreement called for no jail time, and many beseeched Judge Jones to reconsider incarceration for the three. "I think jail is too good for you guys," said Lynn Lacascio from Palm Harbor, Florida. Her son was still struggling with addiction, having been prescribed OxyContin after surgery resulting from a car accident. "I think you should go spend some time in a rehab facility like my son did and watch that. Maybe you'll change your minds." Lawyers for the executives argued that the shame of criminal charges was punishment enough. They reiterated over and over that the men, the top corporate executives who had directed the company's legal, financial, and pharmaceutical divisions, had personally done nothing wrong. Representing Udell, attorney Mary Jo White called the company's head lawyer the moral compass of the company, pointing out that Purdue, at Udell's urging, had voluntarily taken the 160-milligram pill off the market after safety concerns became known. Udell had championed prescription monitoring programs when most others in the industry were opposed, and he was behind the suspension of shipments of OxyContin to Mexico.